In 21, we will examine rational forecasting in an uncertain world. For now, we should keep in mind that a positive trend suggests, but does not prove, that we have been doing something right, and that we should seek to identify what it is and do more of it. When all these objections are exhausted, I often see people racking their brains to find some way in which the news cannot be as good as the data suggest. In desperation, they turn to semantics. Isn't internet trolling a form of violence? Isn't strip mining a form of violence? Isn't inequality a form of violence? Isn't pollution a form of violence? Isn't poverty a form of violence? Isn't consumerism a form of violence? Isn't divorce a form of violence? Isn't advertising a form of violence? Isn't keeping statistics on violence a form of violence? As wonderful as metaphor is as a rhetorical device, it is a poor way to assess the state of humanity. Moral reasoning requires proportionality. It may be upsetting when someone says mean things on Twitter, but it is not the same as the slave trade or the Holocaust. It also requires distinguishing rhetoric from reality. Marching into a rape crisis center and demanding to know what they have done about the rape of the environment does nothing for rape victims and nothing for the environment. Finally, improving the world requires an understanding of cause and effect. Though primitive moral intuitions tend to lump bad things together and find a villain to blame them on, there is no coherent phenomenon of bad things that we can seek to understand and eliminate. Entropy and evolution will generate them in profusion. War, crime, pollution, poverty, disease, and incivility are evils that may have little in common. And if we want to reduce them, we can't play word games that make it impossible even to discuss them individually. I have run through these objections to prepare the way for my presentation of other measures of human progress. The incredulous reaction to Better Angels convinced me that it isn't just the availability heuristic that makes people fatalistic about progress, nor can the media's fondness for bad news be blamed entirely on a cynical chase for eyeballs and clicks. No, the psychological roots of progressophobia run deeper. The deepest is a bias that has been summarized in the slogan, "Bad is stronger than good." The idea can be captured in a set of thought experiments suggested by Tversky. How much better can you imagine yourself feeling than you are feeling right now? How much worse can you imagine yourself feeling? In answering the first hypothetical, most of us can imagine a bit more of a spring in our step or a twinkle in our eye, but the answer to the second one is, it's bottomless. This asymmetry in mood can be explained by an asymmetry in life, a corollary of the law of entropy. How many things could happen to you today that would leave you much better off? How many things could happen that would leave you much worse off? Once again, to answer the first question, we can all come up with the odd windfall or stroke of good luck, but the answer to the second one is, it's endless. But we needn't rely on our imaginations. The psychological literature confirms that people dread losses more than they look forward to gains, that they dwell on setbacks more than they savor good fortune, and that they are more stung by criticism than they are heartened by praise. As a psycholinguist, I am compelled to add that the English language has far more words for negative emotions than for positive ones. One exception to the negativity bias is found in autobiographical memory. Though we tend to remember bad events as well as we remember good ones, the negative coloring of the misfortunes fades with time, particularly the ones that happened to us. We are wired for nostalgia. In human memory, time heals most wounds. Two other illusions mislead us into thinking that things ain't what they used to be. We mistake the growing burdens of maturity and parenthood for a less innocent world, and we mistake a decline in our own faculties for a decline in the times. As the columnist Franklin Pierce Adams pointed out, nothing is more responsible for the good old days than a bad memory. Intellectual culture should strive to counteract our cognitive biases, but all too often it reinforces them. The cure for the availability bias is quantitative thinking, but the literary scholar Stephen Connor has noted that there is in the arts and humanities an exceptionless consensus about the encroaching horror of the domain of number. This ideological rather than accidental innumeracy leads writers to notice, for example, that wars take place today and wars took place in the past, and to conclude that nothing has changed, failing to acknowledge the difference between an era with a handful of wars that collectively kill in the thousands and an era with dozens of wars that collectively killed in the millions. And it leaves them unappreciative of systemic processes that eke out incremental improvements over the long term. Nor is intellectual culture equipped to treat the negativity bias. Indeed, our vigilance for bad things around us opens up a market for professional curmudgeons who call our attention to bad things we may have missed. Experiments have shown that a critic who pans a book is perceived as more competent than a critic who praises it, and the same may be true of critics of society. Always predict the worst and you'll be hailed as a prophet, the musical humorist Tom Lehrer once advised. At least since the time of the Hebrew prophets who blended their social criticism with forewarnings of disaster, pessimism has been equated with moral seriousness. Journalists believe that by accentuating the negative, they are discharging their duty as watchdogs, muckrakers, whistleblowers, and afflictors of the comfortable. And intellectuals know they can attain instant gravitas by pointing to an unsolved problem and theorizing that it is a symptom of a sick society. The converse is true as well. The financial writer Morgan Housel has observed that while pessimists sound like they're trying to help you, optimists sound like they're trying to sell you something. Whenever someone offers a solution to a problem, critics will be quick to point out that it is not a panacea, a silver bullet, a magic bullet, or a one-size-fits-all solution. It's just a band-aid or a quick technological fix that fails to get at the root causes and will blow back with side effects and unintended consequences. Of course, since nothing is a panacea, and everything has side effects, you can't do just one thing, these common tropes are little more than a refusal to entertain the possibility that anything can ever be improved. Pessimism among the intelligentsia can also be a form of one-upmanship. A modern society is a league of political, industrial, financial, technological, military, and intellectual elites, all competing for prestige and influence, and with differing responsibilities for making the society run. Complaining about modern society can be a backhanded way of putting down one's rivals, for academics to feel superior to business people to feel superior to politicians, and so on. As Thomas Hobbes noted in 1651, "Competition of praise inclineth to a reverence of antiquity, for men contend with the living, not with the dead." Pessimism, to be sure, has a bright side. The expanding circle of sympathy makes us concerned about harms that would have passed unnoticed in more callous times. Today we recognize the Syrian civil war as a humanitarian tragedy. The wars of earlier decades, such as the Chinese Civil War, the partition of India, and the Korean War, are seldom remembered that way, though they killed and displaced more people. When I grew up, bullying was considered a natural part of boyhood. It would have strained belief to think that someday, the President of the United States would deliver a speech about its evils, as Barack Obama did in 2011. As we care about more of humanity, we're apt to mistake the harms around us for signs of how low the world has sunk, rather than how high our standards have risen. But relentless negativity can itself have unintended consequences, and recently, a few journalists have begun to point them out. In the wake of the 2016 American election, the New York Times writers David Bornstein and Tina Rosenberg reflected on the media's role in its shocking outcome. Trump was the beneficiary of a belief, near universal in American journalism, that serious news can essentially be defined as what's going wrong. For decades, journalism's steady focus on problems and seemingly incurable pathologies was preparing the soil that allowed Trump's seeds of discontent and despair to take root. One consequence is that many Americans today have difficulty imagining, valuing, or even believing in the promise of incremental system change, which leads to a greater appetite for revolutionary, smash-the-machine change. Bornstein and Rosenberg don't blame the usual culprits, cable TV, social media, late-night comedians, but instead trace it to the shift during the Vietnam and Watergate eras from glorifying leaders to checking their power, with an overshoot toward indiscriminate cynicism, in which everything about America's civic actors invites an aggressive takedown. If the roots of progressive phobia lie in human nature, is my suggestion that it is on the rise itself an illusion of the availability bias? Anticipating the methods I will use in the rest of the book, let's look at an objective measure. The data scientist Kalev Litaru applied a technique called sentiment mining to every article published in the New York Times between 1945 and 2005, and to an archive of translated articles and broadcasts from 130 countries between 1979 and 2010. Sentiment mining assesses the emotional tone of a text by tallying the number and context of words with positive and negative connotations, like good, nice, terrible, and horrific. Figure 4-1 shows the results. For this and all other graphs referred to in this audiobook, please consult the downloadable PDF that supplements this program. Putting aside the wiggles and waves that reflect the crises of the day, we see that the impression that the news has become more negative over time is real. The New York Times got steadily more morose from the early 1960s to the early 1970s, lightened up a bit, but just a bit, in the 1980s and 1990s, and then sank into a progressively worse mood in the first decade of the new century. News outlets in the rest of the world, too, became gloomier and gloomier from the late 1970s to the present day. So has the world really gone steadily downhill during these decades? Keep Figure 4-1 in mind as we examine the state of humanity in the chapters to come. What is progress? You might think that the question is so subjective and culturally relative as to be forever unanswerable. In fact, it's one of the easier questions to answer. Most people agree that life is better than death. Health is better than sickness. Sustenance is better than hunger. Abundance is better than poverty. Peace is better than war. Safety is better than danger. Freedom is better than tyranny. Equal rights are better than bigotry and discrimination. Literacy is better than illiteracy. Knowledge is better than ignorance. Intelligence is better than dull-wittedness. Happiness is better than misery. Opportunities to enjoy family, friends, culture, and nature are better than drudgery and monotony. All these things can be measured. If they have increased over time, that is progress. Granted, not everyone would agree on the exact list. The values are avowedly humanistic and leave out religious, romantic, and aristocratic virtues like salvation, grace, sacredness, heroism, honor, glory, and authenticity. But most would agree that it's a necessary start. It's easy to extol transcendent values in the abstract, but most people prioritize life, health, safety, literacy, sustenance, and stimulation for the obvious reason that these goods are a prerequisite to everything else. If you're listening to this, you are not dead, starving, destitute, moribund, terrified, enslaved, or illiterate, which means that you're in no position to turn your nose up at these values, or to deny that other people should share your good fortune. As it happens, the world does agree on these values. In the year 2000, all 189 members of the United Nations, together with 24 international organizations, agreed on 8 Millennium Development Goals for the year 2015 that blend right into this list. And here is a shocker. The world has made spectacular progress in every single measure of human well-being. Here is a second shocker. Almost no one knows about it. Information about human progress, though absent from major news outlets and intellectual forums, is easy enough to find. The data are not entombed in dry reports but are displayed in gorgeous websites, particularly Max Roser's Our World in Data, Marion Tupi's Human Progress, and Hans Rosling's Gapminder. Rosling learned that not even swallowing a sword during a 2007 TED Talk was enough to get the world's attention. The case has been made in beautifully written books, some by Nobel laureates, which flaunt the news in their titles. Progress, The Progress Paradox, Infinite Progress, The Infinite Resource, The Rational Optimist, The Case for Rational Optimism, Utopia for Realists, Mass Flourishing, Abundance, The Improving State of the World, Getting Better, The End of Doom, The Moral Arc, The Big Ratchet, The Great Escape, The Great Surge, The Great Convergence. None was recognized with a major prize, but over the period in which they appeared, Pulitzers in nonfiction were given to 4 books on genocide, 3 on terrorism, 2 on cancer, 2 on racism, and 1 on extinction. And for those whose reading habits tend toward listicles, recent years have offered 5 amazing pieces of good news nobody is reporting. 5 reasons why 2013 was the best year in human history. 7 reasons the world looks worse than it really is. 29 charts and maps that show the world is getting much, much better. 40 ways the world is getting better, and my favorite, 50 reasons we're living through the greatest period in world history. Let's look at some of those reasons. Chapter 5. Life. The struggle to stay alive is the primal urge of animate beings, and humans deploy their ingenuity and conscious resolve to stave off death as long as possible. Choose life so that you and your children may live, commanded the God of the Hebrew Bible. Rage, rage against the dying of the light, adjured Dylan Thomas. A long life is the ultimate blessing. How long do you think an average person in the world can be expected to live today? Bear in mind that the global average is dragged down by the premature deaths from hunger and disease in the populous countries in the developing world, particularly by the deaths of infants who mix a lot of zeros into the average. The answer for 2015 is 71.4 years. How close is that to your guess? In a recent survey, Hans Rosling found that less than 1 in 4 Swedes guessed that it was that high, a finding consistent with the results of other multinational surveys of opinions on longevity, literacy, and poverty, in what Rosling dubbed the Ignorance Project. The logo of the project is a chimpanzee because, as Rosling explained, if for each question I wrote the alternatives on bananas and asked chimpanzees in the zoo to pick the right answers, they'd have done better than the respondents. The respondents, including students and professors of global health, were not so much ignorant as fallaciously pessimistic. Figure 5-1 in your PDF, a plot from Max Roser of life expectancy over the centuries, displays a general pattern in world history. At the time when the lines begin, in the mid-18th century, life expectancy in Europe and the Americas was around 35, where it had been parked for the 225 previous years for which we have data. Life expectancy for the world as a whole was 29. These numbers are in the range of expected lifespans for most of human history. The life expectancy of hunter-gatherers is around 32.5, and it probably decreased among the peoples who first took up farming because of their starchy diet and the diseases they caught from their livestock and each other. It returned to the low 30s by the Bronze Age, where it stayed put for thousands of years, with small fluctuations across centuries and regions. This period in human history may be called the Malthusian era, when any advance in agriculture or health was quickly cancelled by the resulting bulge in population, though era is an odd term for 99.9% of our species' existence. But starting in the 19th century, the world embarked on the Great Escape, the economist Angus Deaton's term for humanity's release from its patrimony of poverty, disease, and early death. Life expectancy began to rise, picked up speed in the 20th century, and shows no signs of slowing down. As the economic historian Johan Norberg points out, we tend to think that we approach death by 1 year for every year we age. But during the 20th century, the average person approached death by just 7 months for every year they aged. Thrillingly, the gift of longevity is spreading to all of humankind, including the world's poorest countries, and at a much faster pace than it did in the rich ones. Life expectancy in Kenya increased by almost 10 years between 2003 and 2013, Norberg writes. After having lived, loved, and struggled for a whole decade, the average person in Kenya had not lost a single year of their remaining lifetime. Everyone got 10 years older, yet death had not come a step closer. As a result, inequality in life expectancy, which opened up during the Great Escape when a few fortunate countries broke away from the pack, is shrinking as the rest catch up. In 1800, no country in the world had a life expectancy above 40. By 1950, it had grown to around 60 in Europe and the Americas, leaving Africa and Asia far behind. But since then, Asia has shot up at twice the European rate, and Africa at 1.5 times the rate. An African born today can expect to live as long as a person born in the Americas in 1950 or in Europe in the 1930s. The average would have been longer still were it not for the calamity of AIDS, which caused the terrible trough in the 1990s before antiretroviral drugs started to bring it under control. The African AIDS dip is a reminder that progress is not an escalator that inexorably raises the well-being of every human everywhere all the time. That would be magic. And progress is an outcome not of magic, but of problem-solving. Problems are inevitable, and at times, particular sectors of humanity have suffered terrible setbacks. In addition to the African AIDS epidemic, longevity went into reverse for young adults worldwide during the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918 to 1919, and for middle-aged, non-college-educated, non-Hispanic white Americans in the early 21st century. But problems are solvable, and the fact that longevity continues to increase in every other Western demographic means that solutions to the problems facing this one exist as well. Average lifespans are stretched the most by decreases in infant and child mortality, both because children are fragile and because the death of a child brings down the average more than the death of a 60-year-old. Figure 5-2 in your PDF shows what has happened to child mortality since the Age of Enlightenment in 5 countries that are more or less representative of their continents. Look at the numbers on the vertical axis. They refer to the percentage of children who die before reaching the age of 5. Yes, well into the 19th century in Sweden, one of the world's wealthiest countries, between 25% and 33% of all children died before their 5th birthday, and in some years the death toll was close to half. This appears to be typical in human history. 1/5 of hunter-gatherer children die in their first year, and almost half before they reach adulthood. The spikiness in the curve before the 20th century reflects not just noise in the data, but the parlous nature of life. An epidemic, war, or famine could bring death to one's door at any time. Even the well-to-do could be struck by tragedy. Charles Darwin lost 2 children in infancy, and his beloved daughter Annie at the age of 10. Then a remarkable thing happened. The rate of child mortality plunged 100-fold to a fraction of a percentage point in developed countries, and the plunge went global. As Deaton observed in 2013, there is not a single country in the world where infant or child mortality today is not lower than it was in 1950. In sub-Saharan Africa, the child mortality rate has fallen from around 1 in 4 in the 1960s to less than 1 in 10 in 2015. And the global rate has fallen from 18% to 4%, still too high, but sure to come down if the current thrust to improve global health continues. Remember 2 facts behind the numbers. One is demographic. When fewer children die, parents have fewer children, since they no longer have to hedge their bets against losing their entire families. So contrary to the worry that saving children's lives would only set off a population bomb, a major eco-panic of the 1960s and 1970s, which led to calls for reducing health care in the developing world, the decline in child mortality has diffused it. The other is personal. The loss of a child is among the most devastating experiences. Imagine the tragedy, then try to imagine it another million times. That's a quarter of the number of children who did not die last year alone, who would have died had they been born 15 years earlier. Now repeat, 200 times or so, for the years since the decline in child mortality began. Graphs like Figure 5-2 display a triumph of human well-being whose magnitude the mind cannot begin to comprehend. Just as difficult to appreciate is humanity's impending triumph over another of nature's cruelties, the death of a mother in childbirth. The God of the Hebrew Bible, ever merciful, told the first woman, "I will multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children." Until recently, about 1% of mothers died in the process. For an American woman, being pregnant a century ago was almost as dangerous as having breast cancer today. Figure 5-3 shows the trajectory of maternal mortality since 1751 in four countries that are representative of their regions: Ethiopia, Malaysia, the United States, and Sweden. Starting in the late 18th century in Europe, the mortality rate plummeted 300-fold, from 1.2 to 0.004%. The declines have spread to the rest of the world, including the poorest countries, where the death rate has fallen even faster, though for a shorter time because of their later start. The rate for the entire world, after dropping almost in half in just 25 years, is now about 0.2%. around where Sweden was in 1941. You may be wondering whether the drops in child mortality explain all the gains in longevity shown in Figure 5-1. Are we really living longer, or are we just surviving infancy in greater numbers? After all, the fact that people before the 19th century had an average life expectancy at birth of around 30 years doesn't mean that everyone dropped dead on their 30th birthday. The many children who died pulled the average down, canceling the boost of the people who died of old age, and these seniors can be found in every society. In the time of the Bible, the days of our years were said to be 70, and that's the age at which Socrates' life was cut short in 399 BCE, not by natural causes, but by a cup of hemlock. Most hunter-gatherer tribes have plenty of people in their 70s and even some in their 80s. Though a Hadza woman's life expectancy at birth is 32.5 years, if she makes it to 45, she can expect to live another 21 years. So do those of us who survive the ordeals of childbirth and childhood today live any longer than the survivors of earlier eras? Yes, much longer. Figure 5-4 shows the life expectancy in the United Kingdom at birth, and the different ages from 1 to 70 over the past three centuries. No matter how old you are, you have more years ahead of you than people of your age did in earlier decades and centuries. A British baby who had survived the hazardous first year of life would have lived to 47 in 1845, 57 in 1905, 72 in 1955, and 81 in 2011. A 30-year-old could look forward to another 33 years of life in 1845, another 36 in 1905, another 43 in 1955, and another 52 in 2011. If Socrates had been acquitted in 1905, he could have expected to live another 9 years, in 1955 another 10, in 2011 another 16. An 80-year-old in 1845 had 5 more years of life. An 80-year-old in 2011, 9 years. Similar trends, though with lower numbers so far, have occurred in every part of the world. For example, a 10-year-old Ethiopian in 1950 could expect to live to 44. A 10-year-old Ethiopian today can expect to live to 61. The economist Stephen Radley has pointed out that The improvements in health among the global poor in the last few decades are so large and widespread that they rank among the greatest achievements in human history. Rarely has the basic well-being of so many people around the world improved so substantially, so quickly. Yet few people are even aware that it is happening. And no, the extra years of life will not be spent senile in a rocking chair. Of course, the longer you live, the more of those years you'll live as an older person, with its inevitable aches and pains. But bodies that are better at resisting a mortal blow are also better at resisting the lesser assaults of disease, injury, and wear. As a lifespan is stretched, our run of vigor is stretched out as well, even if not by the same number of years. A heroic project called the Global Burden of Disease has tried to measure this improvement by tallying not just the number of people who drop dead of each of 291 diseases and disabilities, but how many years of healthy life they lose, weighted by the degree to which each condition compromises the quality of their lives. For the world in 1990, the project estimated that 56.8 of the 64.5 years of life that an average person could be expected to live were years of healthy life. And at least in developed countries, where estimates are available for 2010 as well, we know that out of the 4.7 years of additional expected life we gained in those two decades, 3.8 were healthy years. Numbers like these show that people today live far more years in the pink of health than their ancestors lived altogether, healthy and infirm years combined. For many people, the greatest fear raised by the prospect of a longer life is dementia. But another pleasant surprise has come to light. Between 2000 and 2012, the rate among Americans over 65 fell by a quarter, and the average age at diagnosis rose from 80.7 to 82.4 years. There is still more good news. The curves in Figure 5-4 are not tapestries of your life that have been drawn out and measured by two of the fates and will someday be cut by the third. Rather, they are projections from today's vital statistics, based on the assumption that medical knowledge will be frozen at its current state. It's not that anyone believes that assumption, but in the absence of clairvoyance about future medical advances, we have no other choice. That means you will almost certainly live longer, perhaps much longer than the numbers you read off the vertical axis. People will complain about anything. And in 2001, George W. Bush appointed a President's Council on Bioethics to deal with the looming threat of biomedical advances that promise longer and healthier lives. Its chairman, the physician and public intellectual Leon Cass, decreed that the desire to prolong youthfulness is an expression of a childish and narcissistic wish incompatible with a devotion to posterity, and that the years that would be added to other people's lives were not worth living. Would professional tennis players really enjoy playing 25% more games of tennis? He asks. Most people would rather decide that for themselves. And even if he is right that mortality makes life matter, longevity is not the same as immortality. But the fact that experts' assertions about maximum possible life expectancy have repeatedly been shattered, on average 5 years after they were published, raises the question of whether longevity will increase indefinitely and someday slip the surly bonds of mortality entirely. Should we worry about a world of stodgy multicentenarians who will resist the innovations of 90-something upstarts and perhaps ban the begetting of pesky children altogether? A number of Silicon Valley visionaries are trying to bring that world closer. They have funded research institutes which aim not to chip away at mortality one disease at a time, but to reverse engineer the aging process itself and upgrade our cellular hardware to a version without that bug. The result, they hope, will be an increase in the human lifespan of 50, 100, even 1,000 years. In his 2006 bestseller, The Singularity Is Near, the inventor Ray Kurzweil forecasts that those of us who make it to 2045 will live forever, thanks to advances in genetics Nanotechnology, such as nanobots that will course through our bloodstream and repair our bodies from the inside, and artificial intelligence, which will not just figure out how to do all this, but recursively improve its own intelligence without limit. To readers of medical newsletters and other hypochondriacs, the prospects for immortality look rather different. We certainly find incredible improvements to celebrate, such as a decline in the death rate from cancer over the past 25 years of around a percentage point a year, saving a million lives in the United States alone. But we also are regularly disappointed by miracle drugs that work no better than the placebo, treatments with side effects worse than the disease, and trumpeted benefits that wash out in the meta-analysis. Medical progress today is more Sisyphus than singularity. Lacking the gift of prophecy, no one can say whether scientists will ever find a cure for mortality. But evolution and entropy make it unlikely. Senescence is baked into our genome at every level of organization, because natural selection favors genes that make us vigorous when we are young over those that make us live as long as possible. That bias is built in because of the asymmetry of time. There is a non-zero probability at any moment that we will be felled by an unpreventable accident like a lightning strike or a landslide, making the advantage of any costly longevity gene moot. Biologists would have to reprogram thousands of genes or molecular pathways, each with a small and uncertain effect on longevity, to launch the leap to immortality. And even if we were fitted with perfectly tuned biological hardware, the march of entropy would degrade it. As the physicist Peter Hoffman points out, life pits biology against physics in mortal combat. Violently thrashing molecules constantly collide with the machinery of our cells, including the very machinery that staves off entropy by correcting errors and repairing damage. As damage to the various damage control systems accumulates, the risk of collapse increases exponentially, sooner or later swamping whatever protections biomedical science has given us against constant risks like cancer and organ failure. In my view, the best projection of the outcome of our multi-century war on death is Stein's Law. Things that can't go on forever, don't. As amended by Davies's corollary, things that can't go on forever can go on much longer than you think. Chapter 6. Health. How do we explain the gift of life that has been granted to more and more of our species since the end of the 18th century? The timing offers a clue. In The Great Escape, Deaton writes, "Ever since people rebelled against authority in the Enlightenment and set about using the force of reason to make their lives better, they have found a way to do so. And there is little doubt that they will continue to win victories against the forces of death. The gains in longevity, celebrated in the previous chapter, are the spoils of victory against several of those forces: disease, starvation, war, homicide, accidents, and in this chapter and subsequent ones, I will tell the story of each. For most of human history, the strongest force of death was infectious disease. The nasty feature of evolution in which small, rapidly reproducing organisms make their living at our expense and hitch a ride from body to body in bugs, worms, and bodily effluvia. Epidemics killed by the millions, wiping out entire civilizations, and visited sudden misery on local populations. To take just one example, yellow fever, a viral disease transmitted by mosquitoes, was so named because its victims turned that color before dying in agony. According to an account of an 1878 Memphis epidemic, the sick had crawled into holes, twisted out of shape, their bodies discovered later only by the stench of their decaying flesh. A mother was found dead with her body sprawled across the bed, black vomit-like coffee grounds spattered all over. The children rolling on the floor, groaning. The rich were not spared. In 1836, the wealthiest man in the world, Nathan Meyer Rothschild, died of an infected abscess. Nor the powerful, Various British monarchs were cut down by dysentery, smallpox, pneumonia, typhoid, tuberculosis, and malaria. American presidents, too, were vulnerable. William Henry Harrison fell ill shortly after his inauguration in 1841 and died of septic shock 31 days later. And James Polk succumbed to cholera 3 months after leaving office in 1849. As recently as 1924, the 16-year-old son of a sitting president, Calvin Coolidge, Jr., died of an infected blister he got while playing tennis. Ever-creative Homo sapiens had long fought back against disease with quackery such as prayer, sacrifice, bloodletting, cupping, toxic metals, homeopathy, and squeezing a hen to death against an infected body part. But starting in the late 18th century, with the invention of vaccination and accelerating in the 19th with acceptance of the germ theory of disease, the tide of battle began to turn. Hand-washing, midwifery, mosquito control, and especially the protection of drinking water by public sewerage and chlorinated tap water would come to save billions of lives. Before the 20th century, cities were piled high in excrement, their rivers and lakes viscous with waste, and their residents drinking and washing their clothes in putrid brown liquid. Epidemics were blamed on miasmas, foul-smelling air, until John Snow, 1813 to 1858, the first epidemiologist, determined that cholera-stricken Londoners got their water from an intake pipe that was downstream from an outflow of sewage. Doctors themselves used to be a major health hazard as they went from autopsy to examining room in black coats encrusted with dried blood and pus, probed their patients' wounds with unwashed hands, and sewed them up with sutures they kept in their buttonholes. Until Ignaz Semmelweis, 1818 to 1865, and Joseph Lister, 1827 to 1912, got them to sterilize their hands and equipment. Antisepsis, anesthesia, and blood transfusions allowed surgery to cure rather than torture and mutilate, and antibiotics, antitoxins, and countless other medical advances further beat back the assault of pestilence. The sin of ingratitude may not have made the top seven, but according to Dante, it consigns the sinners to the ninth circle of hell, and that's where post-1960s intellectual culture may find itself because of its amnesia for the conquerors of disease. It wasn't always that way. When I was a boy, a popular literary genre for children was the heroic biography of a medical pioneer such as Edward Jenner, Louis Pasteur, Joseph Lister, Frederick Banting, Charles Best, William Osler, or Alexander Fleming. On April 12, 1955, a team of scientists announced that Jonas Salk's vaccine against polio, the disease that had killed thousands a year, paralyzed Franklin Roosevelt, and sent many children into iron lungs, was proven safe. According to Richard Carter's History of the Discovery on that day, people observed moments of silence, rang bells, honked horns, blew factory whistles, fired salutes, took the rest of the day off, closed their schools or convoked fervid assemblies therein, drank toasts, hugged children, attended church, smiled at strangers, and forgave enemies. The city of New York offered to honor Salk with a ticker tape parade, which he politely declined. And how much thought have you given lately to Karl Landsteiner? Karl who? He only saved a billion lives by his discovery of blood groups. Or how about these other heroes? Abel Wolman, 1892 to 1982, and Lynn Enslow, 1891 to 1957. Discovery, chlorination of water. Lives saved, 177 million. William Fagy, born 1936. Discovery, smallpox eradication strategy. Lives saved, 131 million. Maurice Hillman, 1919 to 2005. Discovery, 8 vaccines. Lives saved, 129 million. John Enders, 1897 to 1985. Discovery, measles vaccine, lives saved, 120 million. Howard Florey, 1898 to 1968, discovery, penicillin, lives saved, 82 million. Gaston Ramon, 1886 to 1963, discovery, diphtheria and tetanus vaccines, lives saved, 60 million. David Nallon, born 1941, discovery, oral rehydration therapy, lives saved, 54 million. Paul Ehrlich, 1854 to 1915, discovery, diphtheria and tetanus antitoxins, lives saved, 42 million. Andreas Grunzig, 1939 to 1985, discovery, angioplasty, lives saved, 15 million. Grace Eldering, 1900 to 1988, and Pearl Kendrick, 1890 to 1980, discovery, whooping cough vaccine, lives saved, 14 million. Gertrude Elion, 1918 to 1999, discovery, rational drug design, lives saved, 5 million. The researchers who assembled these conservative estimates calculate that more than 5 billion lives have been saved so far by the 100 or so scientists they selected. Of course, hero stories don't do justice to the way science is really done. Scientists stand on the shoulders of giants, collaborate in teams, toil in obscurity, and aggregate ideas across worldwide webs. But whether it's the scientists or the science that is ignored, the neglect of the discoveries that transformed life for the better is an indictment of our appreciation of the modern human condition. As a psycholinguist who once wrote an entire book on the past tense, I can single out my favorite example in the history of the English language. It comes from the first sentence of a Wikipedia entry. Smallpox was an infectious disease caused by either of two virus variants, variola major and variola minor. Yes, smallpox was. The disease that got its name from the painful pustules that covered the victim's skin, mouth, and eyes, and that killed more than 300 million people in the 20th century, has ceased to exist. The last case was diagnosed in Somalia in 1977. For this astounding moral triumph, we can thank, among others, Edward Jenner, who discovered vaccination in 1796, the World Health Organization, which in 1959 set the audacious goal of eradicating the disease, and William Fagy, who figured out that vaccinating small but strategically chosen portions of the vulnerable populations would do the job. In Getting Better, the economist Charles Kenny comments, "The total cost of the program over those 10 years was in the region of $312 million, perhaps 32 cents per person in infected countries. The eradication program cost about the same as producing 5 recent Hollywood blockbusters, or the wing of a B-2 bomber, or a little under 1/10 the cost of Boston's recent road improvement project, nicknamed the Big Dig. However much one admires the improved views of the Boston waterfront, the lines of the stealth bomber, or the acting skills of Keira Knightley in Pirates of the Caribbean, or indeed of the gorilla in King Kong, this still seems like a very good deal." Even as a resident of the Boston waterfront, I'd have to agree. But this stupendous achievement was only the beginning. Wikipedia's definition of rinderpest, cattle plague, which starved millions of farmers and herders throughout history by wiping out their livestock, is also in the past tense. And 4 other sources of misery in the developing world are slated for eradication. Jonas Salk did not live to see the Global Polio Eradication Initiative approach its goal. By 2016, the disease had been beaten back to just 37 cases in 3 countries, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Nigeria, the lowest in history, with an even lower rate thus far in 2017. Guinea worm is a 3-foot-long parasite that worms its way into the victim's lower limbs and diabolically forms a painful blister. When the sufferer soaks his or her foot for relief, the blister bursts, releasing thousands of larvae into the water, which other people drink, continuing the cycle. The only treatment consists of pulling the worm out over several days or weeks. But thanks to a 3-decade campaign of education and water treatment by the Carter Center, the number of cases fell from 3.5 million in 21 countries in 1986 to just 25 cases in 3 countries in 2016, and just 3 in 1 country in the first quarter of 2017. Elephantiasis, river blindness, and blinding trachoma, whose symptoms are as bad as they sound, may also be defined in the past tense by 2030, and measles, rubella, yaws, sleeping sickness, and hookworm are in epidemiologists' sights as well. Will any of these triumphs be heralded with moments of silence, ringing bells, honking horns, people smiling at strangers and forgiving their enemies? Even diseases that are not obliterated are being decimated. Between 2000 and 2015, the number of deaths from malaria, which in the past killed half the people who had ever lived, fell by 60%. The World Health Organization has adopted a plan to reduce the rate by another 90% by 2030, and to eliminate it from 35 of the 97 countries in which it is endemic today, just as it was eliminated from the United States, where it had been endemic until 1951. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has adopted the goal of eradicating it altogether. As we saw in Chapter 5, in the 1990s, HIV/AIDS in Africa was a setback for humanity's progress in lengthening lifespans. But the tide turned in the next decade, and the global death rate for children was cut in half, emboldening the UN to agree in 2016 to a plan to end the AIDS epidemic, though not necessarily to eradicate the virus, by 2030. Figure 6-1 in your PDF shows that between 2000 and 2013, the world also saw massive reductions in the number of children dying from the 5 most lethal infectious diseases. In all, the control of infectious disease since 1990 has saved the lives of more than 100 million children. And in the most ambitious plan of all, a team of global health experts led by the economists Dean Jameson and Lawrence Summers have laid out a roadmap for a grand convergence in global health by 2035, when infectious, maternal, and child deaths everywhere in the world could be reduced to the levels found in the healthiest middle-income countries today. As impressive as the conquest of infectious disease in Europe and America was, the ongoing progress among the global poor is even more astonishing. Part of the explanation lies in economic development, Chapter 8, because a richer world is a healthier world. Part lies in the expanding circle of sympathy, which inspired global leaders such as Bill Gates, Jimmy Carter, and Bill Clinton to make their legacy the health of the poor in distant continents, rather than glittering buildings close to home. George W. Bush, for his part, has been praised by even his harshest critics for his policy on African AIDS relief, which saved millions of lives. But the most powerful contributor was science. It is knowledge that is the key, Deaton argues. Income, although important both in and of itself, and as a component of well-being, is not the ultimate cause of well-being. The fruits of science are not just high-tech pharmaceuticals such as vaccines, antibiotics, antiretrovirals, and deworming pills. They also comprise ideas. Ideas that may be cheap to implement and obvious in retrospect, but which save millions of lives. Examples include boiling, filtering, or adding bleach to water, washing hands, giving iodine supplements to pregnant women, breastfeeding and cuddling infants, defecating in latrines rather than in fields, streets, and waterways, protecting sleeping children with insecticide-impregnated bed nets, and treating diarrhea with a solution of salt and sugar in clean water. Conversely, progress can be reversed by bad ideas, such as the conspiracy theory spread by the Taliban and Boko Haram that vaccines sterilize Muslim girls, or the one spread by affluent American activists that vaccines cause autism. Deegan notes that even the idea that lies at the core of the Enlightenment, knowledge can make us better off, may come as a revelation in the parts of the world where people are resigned to their poor health, never dreaming that changes to their institutions and norms could improve it. Chapter 7. Sustenance. Together with senescence, childbirth, and pathogens, another mean trick has been played on us by evolution and entropy, our ceaseless need for energy. Famine has long been part of the human condition. The Hebrew Bible tells of 7 lean years in Egypt. The Christian Bible has famine as one of the 4 horsemen of the apocalypse. Well into the 19th century, a crop failure could bring sudden misery even to privileged parts of the world. Johann Norberg quotes the childhood reminiscence of a contemporary of one of his ancestors in Sweden in the winter of 1868. "We often saw mother weeping to herself, and it was hard on a mother, not having any food to put on the table for her hungry children. Emaciated, starving children were often seen going from farm to farm, begging for a few crumbs of bread. One day 3 children came to us, crying and begging for something to still the pangs of hunger. Sadly, her eyes brimming with tears, our mother was forced to tell them that we had nothing but a few crumbs of bread, which we ourselves needed. When we children saw the anguish in the unknown children's supplicatory eyes, we burst into tears and begged mother to share with them what crumbs we had. Hesitantly, she acceded to our request, and the unknown children wolfed down the food before going on to the next farm, which was a good way off from our home. The following day, all 3 were found dead, between our farm and the next." The historian Fernand Braudel has documented that pre-modern Europe suffered from famines every few decades. Desperate peasants would harvest grain before it was ripe, eat grass or human flesh, and pour into cities to beg. Even in good times, many would get the bulk of their calories from bread or gruel, and not many at that. In The Escape from Hunger and Premature Death, 1700 to 2100, the economist Robert Fogel noted that the energy value of the typical diet in France at the start of the 18th century was as low as that of Rwanda in 1965. The most malnourished nation for that year. Many of those who were not starving were too weak to work, which locked them into poverty. Hungry Europeans titillated themselves with food pornography, such as tales of Cockaigne, a country where pancakes grew on trees. The streets were paved with pastry, roasted pigs wandered around with knives in their backs for easy carving, and cooked fish jumped out of the water and landed at one's feet. Today we live in Cockaigne, and our problem is not too few calories, but too many. As the comedian Chris Rock observed, "This is the first society in history where the poor people are fat." With the usual first world ingratitude, modern social critics rail against the obesity epidemic with a level of outrage that might be appropriate for a famine, that is, when they are not railing at fat-shaming, slender fashion models, or eating disorders. Though obesity surely is a public health problem, by the standards of history, it's a good problem to have. What about the rest of the world? The hunger that many Westerners associate with Africa and Asia is by no means a modern phenomenon. India and China have always been vulnerable to famine, because millions of people subsisted on rice that was watered by erratic monsoons or fragile irrigation systems and had to be transported across great distances. Braudel recounts the testimony of a Dutch merchant who was in India during a famine in 1630 to 1631. "Men abandoned towns and villages and wandered helplessly. It was easy to recognize their condition, eyes sunk deep in the head, lips pale and covered with slime, the skin hard, with the bones showing through. the belly nothing but a pouch hanging down empty. One would cry and howl for hunger while another lay stretched on the ground dying in misery. The familiar human dramas followed, wives and children abandoned, children sold by parents who either abandoned them or sold themselves in order to survive,